How Eternity Slipped In, by Alexander Thompson. The inspired scriptures never speak of eternity. They describe nothing as eternal. They contain no term which in itself bears our time sense of everlasting. As eternity is not a subject of revelation, our present object is to discover how and when this unscriptural term gained entrance into theology, with most disastrous results. As this is really a historical investigation, it will be necessary to allude to a considerable number of historical events, and to quote from a number of bygone translators and their versions. It is hoped that such a study, along with an examination of various primitive words dealing with time, will dispel any doubts in the minds of those who do not feel thoroughly assured regarding the use of the word aeonian in place of eternal. It may be stated, without fear of contradiction, that the more one explores into the early centuries of Christendom, the clearer does it become that a corrupt theology was alone responsible for displacing the teaching regarding the aeons by a dogma respecting eternity. One statement in English Bibles which perhaps more than any other has led men's minds astray is found in Rev. 1:06. Wycliffe 1380 rendered this, Timsel no more be, having been partly misled by the Latin Vulgate of Jerome AD 380, which he used as his basis. Could he have had the Greek text as a basis, the likelihood is that he would not have used the word time. Jerome rendered it, Time will not be further, tempus non erit amplius. While his translation is on the whole a most faithful and excellent one, in some cases the words he utilizes do not quite match the Greek he translates. The result was that Wycliffe became the medium through whom inaccurate or false terms passed into English theology, and into our modern Bibles, where they have become stereotyped. The consequences have been very far-reaching and most deplorable. Further examples will be cited anon. The Authorized Version reads, There should be time no longer. The Concordant Version reads, There will be no longer delay. This makes clear and simple sense, and presents no difficulty. But the erroneous rendering which has persisted for over 500 years since the time of Wycliffe is quite out of harmony with the context. Anyone can see that after the events detailed in the 10th chapter of the Unveiling, there is an entire millennial period to follow, during which time continues. The Revised Version has a reading similar to the Avenue, but corrects this in the margin to there shall be delay no longer. Nevertheless, the false notion that time must someday end and eternity commence, still clings to theology. All that the scriptures reveal is that the aeons will terminate 1 Cor. 10:11, Heb. 9:26, but it seems clear that time of some kind or other must continue. When it is revealed that certain things are to continue after the aeons have terminated, or when anything is described as being interminable, a distinct negative particle is used in the Greek to denote this, as in the following examples, Luke 1:33 of his kingdom there shall be no consummation, Lukistitilos, not will be finish. 1 Cor. 15:42 it is roused in incorruption of Tarsha, un corruption. 53 this mortal must put on immortality, Athanasia, un death, deathlessness. 1 Pet. 1:4 an allotment incorruptible and undefiled and unfading, amarandon, un fading. Heb. 7:16 the power of an indissoluble life, a cataluton, un down loosed. 1 Tim. 1:4 interminable genealogies, apparanton, un other side. As the aeons are to terminate, it follows that all that is aeonian must finish, or be swallowed up in that which follows. Even dooms, which are described as aeonian, such as the fire of Matt 1:8:8, the extermination from the face of the Lord, of 2 Thess 1:9, and the aeonian judgment of Heb. 6:2, shall terminate in due season. In vivid contrast to such mere aeonian doom stands the awful doom of the city of Babylon, as portrayed in Rev. 1:8:21-23, where within the compass of three verses occurs the solemn negative expression nevermore, amiti, not no still, no fewer than 6 times. Thus, Babylon, the great city, will be hurled down, and she may be found in her nevermore. And the sound of the lyre singers and entertainers, and flutists and trumpeters shall be heard in you nevermore. And every artisan of every trade may be found in you nevermore. And the sound of a millstone shall be heard in you nevermore. And the light of a lamp may be appearing in you nevermore. And the voice of the bridegroom and bride shall be heard in you nevermore. Even to God the scriptures do not ascribe eternity. What need is there to describe him as eternal? Would it not be almost an affront to use such an epithet of one who must, in order to be God, be eternal? We speak not of wet rain falling from the clouds. Were it not wet, it would not be rain. In the beginning of Genesis, the fact of God, and the existence of God, are taken for granted. No attempt is made to explain who God is and whence he came, or to account for his existence. Nature demands his existence, and faith assumes him. That he is the Aeonian God, Rom 1:26-26, is a distinct and added revelation. Just as evil is a special feature of the aeons, so God is seen as the Aeonian God during the same time. While it is not possible for God to be more than eternal, he is more than Aeonian. Upon a lead tablet found in the necropolis at Hadrumetum, in the Roman province of Africa, near Carthage, belonging to the early 3rd century, the following inscription is scratched in Greek: I am adjuring thee, the great God, the Aeonian and more than Aeonian, Aeonian and Almighty, the one up above gods. Deus man requires to render this as follows: the eternal and more than eternal and almighty, who is exalted above the exalted gods. The Hebrew scriptures are written almost entirely in pure Hebrew. There are very few words which are not Hebrew. So with the Greek scriptures. They contain few words which are not of pure Greek. But our English Bible is very different. Had it been rendered in simple, homely, native English words alone, it would have read very differently. It is true that numerically the great bulk of the words employed are pure English, but many of the important doctrinal terms are words adopted either from Latin or Greek. The German Bible is very much more pure German than the English Bible is pure English. What is the most important thing in the scriptures for the sinner? Many will answer, salvation. Yet this important term only came into use in the English language about the 12th century, say 800 years ago. It is a purely Latin word. At that time it bore the meanings both of safety or salvation, and of health. The believer's salvation was his health. Salvation occurs not once in the Anglo-Saxon scriptures 680-900 AD, or in Wycliffe's version 1380 AD. Wycliffe always uses the word health, although he uses the terms make safe and safe. The old word used for the Savior was healend, or healer. Not only does he make one safe, but he heals. Tyndale, in the year 1526 AD, was the first one to use the word salvation in the scriptures, and he used it once only, in John 4:22, for salvation cometh of the wis. Wycliffe had, for healed is of Jewish. Thereafter the fine old English word health dropped out, and was completely displaced by the imported but now most important Latin word salvation. While it is true that the revival of learning and letters in the 15th century greatly enriched the English language, it drove out thousands of very fine English words. Previous to the time, it had sometimes been necessary to use a double word to give the necessary meaning in the scriptures. Thus, in the Anglo-Saxon Gospels of about the time of King Alfred, about 1,000 years ago, the following expressions are met with: Leonin knicht, learning knight, for disciple, a Latin word. Hundreds old or man, alderman of 100, for centurion, also a Latin word. Beseared, bookwork, bookman, for scribe, another Latin word. Big spell, near story, example, like German Beispiel, for the Greek parable. Eternal is one of the many hundreds of words which gained entrance into English during the Renaissance. Previous to the time, it was completely unknown. No such word appears in any Old English scriptures. Instead of it, there is found a simple little word with the meaning of Aeonian, or something like that, spelt Aes, of which more will be said later. In fact, it may be laid down as a rule that no language had, for some time after the 1st century AD, any term to denote eternity. Some of the following facts may at first sight seem somewhat startling, yet that is because they are not widely known. Had the Old English Bibles been translated direct out of the Greek, instead of from the Latin Vulgate version of Jerome 380 AD, it is very probable that the word eternal would never have been found in our modern Bibles and theological terminology at all. But for the Norman conquest of England in 1066 AD, which brought many French words into the English language, and French's largely decayed and corrupt Latin, and drove out many native English words, we should most probably now be using not eternal, but Aes, the old equivalent of Aeonian. On the other hand, had the sack of Constantinople by hordes of Turks from Asia taken place prior to the Norman conquest, instead of in 1453, the likelihood is that we should have had the Greek term Aeonian incorporated into English, instead of the Latin eternal. The capture of Constantinople by the Turks was of enormous importance to Europe. It was then the great center of learning, especially Greek learning. When it was sacked, hosts of learned doctors were scattered abroad all over Europe, carrying with them the knowledge of the Greek tongue and the treasures of Greek literature. It is hard to believe that for over 1,000 years, up to the year 1453, Greek was almost unknown or forgotten in most of Europe. Even in Italy, which formerly had been dominated by Greek, it became almost unknown. Very few quotations from Greek poets are to be found in Italian writers from the 6th to the 14th centuries. No Greek was taught publicly in England until about 1484, when it began to be taught at Oxford University. Erasmus, the great Dutch scholar, learned Greek at Oxford and subsequently was professor of Greek at Cambridge from 1509 till 1514, during which time Tyndale studied there. Erasmus issued his first Greek New Testament in 1516. This was the first Greek New Testament printed for sale. The first Greek grammar for well over 1,000 years was published at Milan in 1476, and the first lexicon 4 years later. As an English scholar expressed it, Greece had arisen from the grave with the New Testament in her hand. About this time great German scholars even changed their names to Greek ones, so fashionable had the study of Greek become. Schwarzschild, Black Earth, became Melanchthon. Horsshane, Hausschein, was discarded for Ecolampadius. Gerhard attained fame as Erasmus. Horn took on more dignity as Serotonus. How the Latin language affected theology. In order to understand aright the word eternal, it is necessary to make a review of linguistic conditions in Greece and Italy before and after the days of Paul. The classical Latin tongue was one out of many that was spoken by the early inhabitants of Italy. At first it was only the dialect of a small area around Rome. Other dialects which in the course of time mingled with it were of a very different type, such as the Etruscan. Many colonies of Greeks existed in early times in the south of Italy, so that this part was known as Great Greece. From the dawn of authentic history the Greek language may be seen exerting a strong influence over Italy. When in BC 454 the Romans desired to establish a code of laws, they dispatched commissioners to Greece to study and report upon the laws of Solon at Athens. What in later times became the polished dialect of the district of Latium was not the language of the common people, just as the classical Greek of the poets and dramatists was not the common speech of the people. The everyday language of Greeks was much the same as is found in the Greek scriptures, known as the Koine, or common, or vulgar tongue. Latin was the speech of the patricians, of the literary world, of the politicians, of a comparatively small section of the people. It came to occupy the position of a partly artificial dialect amid many other widely differing dialects. One effect of the rapid conquests of Alexander the Great, BC 334-323, was that Greek became the language of government and literature throughout most of the then civilized world. It became the lingua franca of countries such as Palestine and Egypt. About the year BC 280, Rome was mistress of all Italy except some of the Greek cities in the south. These succumbed by BC 276. 60 years later, Rome was interfering in the affairs of Greece itself, and by BC 189 Rome was mistress of Greece. Nevertheless, Greek continued to be the fashionable speech in Italy for a long time. In the time of Dionysius Thrax, about BC 80, the children of gentlemen in Rome learned Greek before they learned Latin. Dionysius was the author of the first Greek school grammar ever compiled in Europe, published in Rome in the time of Pompey, about BC 50, which became the basis of all subsequent Greek grammars, and was the book used in schools for centuries. This small and elementary work of only a few pages is still in existence. The first history of Rome was written at Rome in Greek by Fabius Pictor about BC 200. In the first 2 centuries AD, Greek was very generally used in Rome. In addition to Latin, numerous other dialects might be heard in the streets of Rome and throughout Italy, and the Greek language served as a common medium whereby all might communicate with each other. For this reason, there was no need for Paul to write his epistle to Rome in Latin. As he was much too sensitive to write to them in a tongue they would not understand, it is clear that the Roman Church must have been quite at home with the Greek tongue. For a similar reason, there was no need for a Latin version of the scriptures in Italy for about 100 years after Paul's time. It is of profound significance to note that when the first Latin version was made, it had its origin, not in Italy, but in North Africa. Of the manuscripts extant belonging to the old Latin version, that is to say, the version in use before the time of Jerome, 380 AD, the majority may be recognized as being of the African type. It is here necessary to explain that what became the Roman province of Africa was in early times the Canaanite colony of Carthage, in North Africa, near Tunis. This colony was founded by the cities of Tyre and Sidon, and some have sought to identify Carthage with Tarshish as the Greek version of Isa.23.1. Carthage ruled over the large islands of Sardinia and Corsica, and over part of Sicily also. Warfare with the rising military power of Rome was inevitable. 3 long struggles, known as the Punic or Phoenician Wars, took place between BC 264 and 146, culminating in the complete subjugation of Carthage, which now became a province of Rome. Henceforth the speech of this Roman colony was Latin, but it was the Latin dialect of about the middle of the 2nd century BC. This is important. The Latin dialect of this time was very different from what it became 100 years later. Polybius, the Greek historian, states, about BC 150, that the best informed Romans of the time could not understand without difficulty the language of the former treaties entered into between Rome and Carthage, less than 100 years before. Horace, who died about the time Christ was born, confessed that he could not understand the old Latin Salian poems, and he infers that Latin had so greatly changed within a few 100 years that no one else could understand them. Quintilian, born 40 AD, states that even the Salian priests could scarcely follow their sacred hymns. The purest era of Latin in Rome was during the 100 years before Christ came. It was then that the language became fixed and polished. Carthage, however, being a colony, at a considerable distance from Rome, spoke a somewhat different Latin than did Rome. It was free from the influence of Greek. Just as the Scandinavian spoken in Norway and Sweden has diverged much from the old Scandinavian of 1,000 years ago still spoken in Iceland, as the Taal of the Boers in South Africa has diverged much from the Dutch of Holland, as the English carried to America 300 years ago has preserved certain words and meanings and lost others, so the Latin transported to Carthage came in course of time to diverge, in certain respects, from the Latin spoken in Italy and Rome. As invariably happens in such cases, certain old expressions and nuances were preserved which died out elsewhere, while in other cases fresh nuances came into use. It is to Tertullian, a Latin of Carthage, who lived from about 160 to 220 AD, that we are indebted for our first knowledge of the existence of the Old Latin version of the scriptures. He was the earliest of the Latin fathers. The manuscripts of this version in existence show that the Latin employed was very different from classical Latin, being more vigorous, yet marked by solecisms or improprieties in the language used what would appear to others as errors in grammar and violations of syntax and idiom. It may have been originally a translation from the Greek made by comparatively illiterate people, or the language may be due simply to the differences in dialect between the Latin of Rome and the Latin of Carthage. So long as the old Latin scriptures remained in North Africa, they continued with little or no change. But immediately they arrived on the soil of Italy, a great disturbance took place. Old words in use in Carthage were found to be unintelligible to the Romans, while new words coined there were not understood. Words in both countries had, in the course of two or three centuries, taken on distinctive and divergent nuances of their own. The provincial solecisms and roughnesses of the African version were patched up and corrected by means of the Greek version current in Italy, and in course of time the result came to be indescribable confusion. There were said to be as many versions as manuscripts, though this is no doubt somewhat of an exaggeration. Upon Jerome fell the arduous task of attempting to bring about harmony out of this confusion, and the outcome was his version of the Latin scriptures, which in after times, from the 13th century onwards, was known as the Vulgate. Hitherto, for about 600 years, the Greek Septuagint version had held the field, and there was intense and prolonged opposition to Jerome's version. This was the Bible which was to dominate most of Christendom for 1,000 years, right up to the Reformation. Jerome, however, in his revision, while correcting obvious errors and setting right what seemed to be bad Latin, was very conservative otherwise. Many expressions he left as he found them. Whatever may have been his own views regarding the future, he does not appear to have revised two Latin words, fraught with profound significance, which he found in the old version. These are both words used to render the Greek word Ian, as Latin, like Gothic and Armenian and English. Found two words necessary, seculum, from which we have our word secular, and eternus, from which have descended the fateful words eternal and eternity. Sometimes, as we shall see, the Greek and Ian was rendered by one of these two Latin words, and sometimes by the other. Not only so, but when the Greek shows the word Ian twice or thrice in one clause, as in for the Ian, and for the Ian of the Ian, the Latin frequently shows both eternus and seculum. This alone ought to be sufficient to prove that the two Latin words could have the same meaning, more or less, and it will be our present purpose to demonstrate that originally the two words differed little in meaning, but that theology, chiefly through the dominating influence of one man, imparted to eternus a nuance alien to its derivation and original usage. We shall now examine the derivation of these two Latin words, one of which was destined to exercise such a profound influence over the minds of men for so long, an influence not in accord with truth, and by no means for the glory of God. Eternal and secular. Seculum is defined in Latin dictionaries as meaning a generation, an age, the world, the times, the spirit of the times, and a period of 100 years. That which is secular pertains to the present world, especially to the world as not spiritual. In French the word has come to mean a century, besides meaning age, time, period, and world, siècle. The future siècle is the life to come. In the French Bible, for the eons of the eons is rendered by to the siècles of the siècles, following the Latin Vulgate. The other Romance languages follow the same construction. Italian using secoli, and Spanish siglos. Irish and Gaelic use sohal, Romanian uses seculi, and even Basque is secular. That is to say, Bibles in these languages render the corrupt forever and ever correctly, or nearly so. Seculum is sometimes derived from the same root that gives sequel, meaning time as following. Before the rise of words to express eternity, time was viewed as flowing onwards, generation following generation into the dim future. Others derive seculum from the root that gives section, as meaning time cut off, divided, or decided. Long ago in Rome, periodic games were held, which were called secular games. Herodian, the historian, writing in Greek about the end of the second or beginning of the third century, calls these Aeonian games. In no sense were the games eternal. Aeonian did not mean eternal any more than a secular meant eternity. Among the many inscriptions in the catacombs of Rome is one to the memory of a girl of 15 years who had died. It is inscribed to Aulia, our sweetest daughter, who departed from the seculum, or world, m-qui de seculo recessit. Some of the old Roman writers use the word in the sense of the utmost lifetime of man, a century. It may be said that every 100 years the race of man is completely changed. Some people change little within a generation, but after 100 years the entire physical appearance of the race has altered. The famous Council of Trent, in Italy, sitting from 1545 to 1563, decreed that this same ancient and vulgate edition, which by the long use of so many centuries has been approved in the church itself, is to be held authentic in public readings, disputations, sermons, and expositions, and no one is to dare or presume to reject it under any pretext whatever. The word used for centuries is seculorum, seculums. Trajan, who was emperor of Rome from 98 to 117 AD, wrote to Pliny regarding the conviction of those who professed the Christian faith. Such were not to be specially sought out or hunted, yet if accused and convicted must bear the punishment. He adds that accusations against them which were not signed were not to be accepted on any account, as this was the very worst example that could be shown, and pertains not to our seculum. Tertullian, born about 160 AD, in one of his many writings, referred to a mighty shock impending over the entire world, and the conclusion of the seculum itself. Lactantius, born about 260 AD, speaks of the learned ones of this seculum. Eusebius, the historian of the early church, born about 265 AD, gives an account of the trial of certain martyrs from Africa in the year 180. The martyrs showed a most indomitable spirit when interrogated by the proconsul. Spiratus, their leader, replied, "The empire of this seculum world I do not recognize." The proconsul pressed them to take 30 days to reconsider. Spiratus replied, "In a matter so straightforward there is no reconsideration." Eusebius goes on to relate that the martyrs would reign with God through all the seculums of the seculums. Writing about our Lord's miracles, Eusebius alludes to magicians who have ever existed throughout the seculums. This is a reference to past ages. These examples are sufficient to show that seculum was used very much as the Grecian. No case can be cited in which it refers to endless time. We shall now consider its usage by Jerome in the Latin Vulgate version. Those who maintain that the Grecian signifies eternity or forever would do well to consider very carefully Jerome's renderings from Greek into Latin. Out of about 130 occurrences of aeon in the Greek New Testament, Jerome renders biseculum 101 times, while he uses eternum 27 times. If by the latter word he meant eternity, he is very inconsistent. It is to the Latin versions that we must look for the origin of the pernicious system, or rather lack of system, of giving to the Greek aeon two diverse meanings. In every occurrence in the unveiling of the expression for the aeons of the aeons, Jerome has, for the seculums of the seculums, which Wycliffe, with studied carefulness, rendered by into world eyes of world eyes, just as 500 years before Wycliffe's time the Old English glosses of Latin manuscripts gave world for seculum. The following are some of the expressions used by Jerome: from the seculums, for the seculum, for the seculums, before the seculums, this seculum, that seculum, the consummation of the seculum, the consummation of the seculums, the ends of the seculums, in the seculum of the seculum, the future seculum, the coming seculum, the impending seculums, the seculum of this world. In Jude 25 he renders by, before the entire seculum, and now, and for all the seculums of the seculums. Wycliffe hears, before alle world eyes and now and into alle world eyes of world eyes. Tyndale, coming 150 years after Wycliffe, has the utterly inadequate and bald and totally erroneous now and forever, although the Reims version 1582 AD has, before all world is, and now and for all world is evermore. In EPH.2.2, Jerome has the seculum of this world, CV, the aeon of this world. Wycliffe did not understand this, and originated the guess, the course of this world, which was slavishly copied by those who came after him. Turning to the Greek word aeonion, which occurs 70 times in the New Testament, Jerome does not render about three quarters of them by the word secular, and one quarter by eternal, but no less than 65 times does he use the latter eternum, while secular he uses only twice, 2 Tim.1:9 and Titus 1:2, before times secular, anti tempora secularia. As 43 of the 70 occurrences refer to life, he was unable to say secular life, and therefore invariably puts eternal life. We thus see that Jerome's renderings of the Greek and completely shake our confidence in him here. By his inconsistency he really contradicts himself. Had Jerome been as consistent in rendering the Greek into Latin as Wycliffe was in rendering Jerome into English, we should never have had our authorized version in its present form. In every case where Jerome uses seculum to represent the Greek and Wycliffe uses world, while in place of Jerome's eternum for this word, Wycliffe always has without end. For this adjective, aeonion, Wycliffe well nigh invariably for Jerome's eternum puts everlasting. An examination of Jerome's Galcan version of the Psalms from the Greek Septuagint reveals further strange inconsistencies. Generally speaking, he renders the Greek for the aeon, eston aeona, by into eternity, in eternum, while the compound occurrences of aeon, such as for the aeon of the aeon, he renders by for the seculum of the seculum. It was not expedient for him to say, into the eternity of the eternity, or into the eternities. The expression for the aeons, eastus aeonas, he was obliged to render for the seculums, in secular, as in Psalm 61:4, 72:17. In the same way, in Psalm 145:13 he renders by a kingdom of all seculums, which corresponds to the Hebrew and the Greek and the avenue margin. In keeping with these apparent rules, he renders the compound Greek expression, for the aeon and for the aeon of the aeon, by the Latin, into eternity and into the seculum of the seculum, in eternum et in seculum seculi, as in PSA 9:5, 10, 16, 45, 17, 48, 14, 52, 8, and 148:6. Yet the same Greek expression, for the aeon, and for the aeon of the aeon, he renders simply by into eternity in 72:19, while it is rendered in 119:44, 145:1,2, 21, by into the seculum, and into the seculum of the seculum. Exceptions to the seeming rule are found in 44:8, 52:9, and 75:9, where the Greek for the aeon is rendered into seculum, in seculum, while in 73:12 it is rendered in seculum, in seculo. In the last mentioned verse, even Jerome could not bring himself to believe that the ungodly prospered for eternity. In PSA.90:2 he renders the Greek from the aeon till the aeon, avenue, from everlasting to everlasting thou art God, by from seculum until seculum. yet the very same Greek expression he renders in 103:17 by from eternity until eternity, ab aeterno et jus in aeternum. Probably Jerome was only translating after the system of the old Latin version, which had existed for 200 years before his time. If that is so, he must have had serious misgivings, if in aeternum meant for eternity or into eternity. In Micah 5:2, where the old Latin had from the days of seculum, Jerome altered to from the days of eternity, ad ebus aeternitatis. We shall now bring forward verses in which the two Latin words we are studying seem to be equated. In 1 Chron. 29:10 the Avenue reads, Blessed be thou, Lord God of Israel our Father, forever and ever. The Hebrew and the Greek both read, from the aeon and until the aeon. In NEH.9:5 the Hebrew and the Greek have the same reading as in 1 Chron. 29:10, Avenue, bless the Lord your God forever and ever. In both of these verses the Vulgate has, from eternity until eternity. Yet in JR.7:7 and 25:5, where the Avenue speaks of dwelling in the land that I gave to your fathers, forever and ever, and the Hebrew and the Greek both have from the aeon and until the aeon, the Vulgate has, from seculum and into seculum. How did the Vulgate translate those verses which speak of the aeon and beyond? This expression, Dean Farrow tells us, was decisive to Origen, and so it ought to be to all who wish to believe God. In ISA.45:17, the Avenue reads, Ye shall not be ashamed nor confounded world without end. The Hebrew reads, For the aeons of the future. The Greek has, till the aeon further. The Vulgate has, until the seculum of the seculum. An extraordinary surprise awaits us when we consider two verses wherein the Vulgate is, to say the least, bewildering. We have been reckoning the Latin in aeternum of Jerome's day as meaning for eternity or into eternity, whatever it may have meant 200 or 300 years before his time. It stands beyond all doubt that by seculum Jerome meant a limited period of time, an aeon, but by aeternum he seems to have meant something different. Did he mean eternity? Or was this Latin word still used in the loose way it had been used long before his time, as meaning indefinite future time? Farrar says that even the Latin fathers who had a competent knowledge of Greek knew that aeternum was used in the same loose way, for an indefinite period, in Latin writers, as aeonion was used in Greek. Exodus 15:18 reads in the Avenue, The Lord shall reign forever and ever. The Hebrew carefully limits this reign to the aeon and further. The Septuagint expands this into the aeon, and still more an aeon, and further. Jerome astounds by actually rendering by into eternity and beyond, in aeternum et altera. The same Latin reading is also found in Micah 4:5, Avenue, We will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever and ever. Where the Hebrew reads, for the aeon and further, and the Greek reads, for the aeon and beyond, it is now necessary to examine the origin of the word eternal. Whatever the Latin word meant in the time of Jerome, it certainly did not signify endless 300 years earlier. Professor Max Muller said of the root of this word, that it originally signified life or time, but had given rise to a number of words expressing eternity, the very opposite of life and time. He says the Latin evum, which corresponds almost letter for letter with the Greek an, aeon, thought to have been originally aeon, became the name of time, age, and its derivative aeternus, or aeternus, was made to express eternity. These are the words of an authority who was quite unbiased in this matter. This statement resembles one made by Favorinus in the 16th century in the famous Etymologicon Magnum, a large tome giving the derivations of all Greek words, as handed down from a very much earlier time. The word aeon is defined, among other things, as the life of mankind, and there is cited the seven aeons from the creation of the heaven and earth until the general resurrection of humanity. Favorinus, the editor, adds an is the imperceptible adios and the unending eteleuthetos, as it seems to the theologian. What he meant was that originally the word never meant unending, but this meaning had been injected by theology. Indeed, he spoke truth, as it is theology, and theology alone, which in any language has imported into time words the thought of endlessness. Before returning to the Latin, we shall cite one more similar yet very instructive case. The Emperor Justinian was the greatest of the Eastern Byzantine emperors. He reigned from 527 to 565 at Constantinople. In the year 534 he published in 50 volumes the world-famous Justinian Code of Laws. This was a digest of the Greek and Roman constitutions, ordinances, and legal decisions, culled from 2,000 manuscript volumes, and it forms the basis of most medieval and modern codes of law. In the year 540, Justinian made arrangements for the calling together of the famous local council of 4 years later. He was determined that certain doctrines must be suppressed. In setting forth the position when writing to the Patriarch Menas of Constantinople, he discussed the doctrines with great ability. In particular, he wished it made very plain that the life of the saints was to be everlasting, and that the doom of the lost was to be likewise. Yet he did not argue that the word aeonian meant everlasting. Nor did he claim that the word aeonian had hitherto been misunderstood. In setting forth the orthodox position of the church of the time, he did not say, "We believe in aeonian punishment," as this was exactly what Origen, 300 years before, had maintained and believed. In fact, Origen, who exulted in the truth of the reconciliation of the universe, definitely used the word aeonian with reference to fire and doom as meaning a limited time. But writing in the very expressive Greek language, Justinian says, "The Holy Church of Christ teaches an endless aeonian aetelutheitos aeonios life for the just, and endless aetelutheitos punishment for the wicked." Justinian knew quite well that by itself aeonian did not signify endless, and he therefore added a word the meaning of which is quite unequivocal, a word not found in the scriptures. This letter of Justinian, which is still in existence, ought to convince anyone who is in doubt regarding the true scriptural meaning of the word aeonian. It may be added that the council, though expressly convened in order to stigmatize the teachings of Origen, one of which was that punishment was only temporary, condemned his views generally, but did not anathematize his teaching regarding the reconciliation of all. It was not until the year 696, at Constantinople, that a council publicly condemned this doctrine of Origen for the first time, the glorious teaching being called drunken ravings as to the future life of the dead. We must now return to the Latin word evum. This is defined in dictionaries as meaning lifetime, life, age, mankind living at a particular time. From this word, through the form eternus, comes the adjective eternus, which is our eternal. Evum is never found in Latin standing for endless time. In the Roman catacombs is the tomb of Alban, who died at the age of 45. Her sorrowing husband, Plucus, marked her resting place with the following words: "This grief will always semper be mine, during lifetime, in evil." Further on is inscribed, "Lie in peace in sleep you will arise." Neither of these two words, therefore, semper, from which comes sempiternal, and evum, from which comes eternal, here meant endless. Another stone bears the inscription, "Eternal home, them must eternalize." This is on the tomb of a believer, so that this could not be his everlasting resting place. Another stone states that Aurelius Felix, who died in January at the age of 55, was snatched home eternally, raptus et endemus. The author of a book on the catacombs is obliged to explain that such inscriptions do not imply any want of belief in the resurrection on the part of those who erected them, because a word apparently meaning eternal is found on them. He did not see that this word only meant aeonian, although he refers to a similar expression in ECC.12.5, "Man goeth to his long home, cv, to his aeonian house." The old Latin writers used aeternum in the same sense as Greek writers used aeonian, as meaning yin-yin. Thus Chisiro, who died BC 43, says of the future, springtime will be eternum, that is, enduring, eon-yin. At present springtime is brief, fleeting, seasonal. He was referring to a spring which will endure. He also refers to God by the same term, as the enduring one. Ovid, who flourished about 9 AD, speaks of warfare in the same sense. As the word eon is really a transliteration of the Greek an, its nearest English equivalent may be found in the word age. The origin of this word is very interesting. It traces its descent back to the Latin evum, which is the equivalent of the Greek an. Ever produced evitas, which became shortened to eaters. From this was formed another form, etaticum, a low Latin term. In France this was slurred into edage, then into arg, which arrived in England as age. How then, did the Latin eternum and the Greek aeonion, which both originally referred to that which is aeonian, come to signify eternal in our modern sense? There is no doubt that these words have been made to express what is eternal, the instrument in every case being theology. The process seems to have been somewhat as follows. There have always been some among the sects who have held harsh views regarding the doom of the sinner. The Pharisees and the Essenes are said to have believed in conscious future punishment. The Essenes believed in unintermittent aeolitan and deathless punishment. It is natural for those in whose hearts the love of God has not been dynamically shed abroad to look upon death as the end of all for mankind. The truth of the aeons became lost very quickly after the time of the Apostle Paul. No one after him appears to say a word about it. Even Origen believed that this present world or aeon was the conclusion of many aeons. He inferred that there are still many aeons to come, not only two. On the other hand, there arose the Gnostic sects, one of which was that of the Valentinians, named after Valentine, a native of Egypt. They flourished in the 2nd century. According to them, the original source of all existence was the abyss, out of which, when life was developed, sprang the aeons, male and female, through whom God revealed himself. These aeons, along with God himself, together made up the fullness or pleroma. Matter they looked upon as evil, and the harmony of the pleroma had been upset by God's having come into contact with matter. In order to restore harmony, there was a new emanation of two aeons, Christ and the Holy Spirit. At the conclusion of the world, Christ would introduce his bride along with all the spiritual ones into the fullness, and all matter, by which is evidently meant all evil, would return to its original nothingness. Another sect taught that seven aeons proceeded forth out from God. Eusebius says that Tatian also invented some invisible aeons like the Valentinians, but Tatian may have preserved some relics of primitive truth. Even in this darkness one can perceive glimmerings of the truth. God made the aeons through his Son, Heb.1:2. God planned out the aeons, and is now utilizing them as his scaffolding. The aeons seem to synchronize with the presence of evil, when it requires to be coped with. The collapse of the truth of the aeons left the way open for pagan error to reassert itself and foist itself upon scripture teaching. So long as the Greek language was well understood in Italy, so long would aeonian retain its force as meaning aeonian, and not only so, but it would tend to keep its Latin equivalent aeternum tied down to the same signification, in Italy. But an influence was arising in the 2nd century in North Africa which was to change everything, and compel these terms to bear, in theology, a meaning they never had originally. It is more than probable that the Latin aeternum bore in North Africa a sense slightly divergent from what it bore in Rome. It may have signified not only aeonian, but something in addition, or something more vague. It seems by that time to have been coming to signify what it later signified everywhere, not only that which has no seen or revealed limit, but also that which is actually without a limit. With us, that which is endless may be either that which for the present or for the time being is without an end, or of which the end is not observed, or it may signify that which never can or will have an end. The following illustration will make this clear. leading into the city of Chester in England is an old Roman highway, which, for about 3 miles, is quite straight, as Roman roads very often were, besides being very flat and monotonous. At the conclusion of a 30-mile walk one day, this part of the road was, to the eye, and to the feelings of the traveller, endless. It was possible to look along the road for over a mile, and observe traffic and pedestrians, but no end to it could be seen. In one sense, the road was endless, yet all the time the city to which it led could be discerned in the distance. The Roman roadmakers were intensely practical. As often as possible, their roads did not deviate by a foot, even though they had to traverse hills, and their roads all led to a definite destination. In the same way, the Latin-speaking theologians of the early centuries abhorred what was indefinite, or liable to be misunderstood. Speculation they shunned and banned. The statements of the creeds which issued forth from the early Roman Church are noted for their extreme brevity. The requisite facts were stated in black and white so that there might be no dubiety as to what people must believe. Roman law, and the Roman military power, functioned like machines. Authority must be obeyed. So in the Roman Church, individualism of thought was not encouraged. As there was much speculation concerning the aeons and the future, the position must needs be stated categorically and dogmatically. Theology had lost the punctuation marks of future time, and something must be put in their place. Moreover, it was humbling to the Latin fathers not to be able to delineate the future. If no one was able to chart the ocean of time, why not simply declare that it was boundless? Would not the Church wield far more power if it proclaimed in authoritative terms that eternal destiny was fixed here on earth? Was it not much more flattering to man to think that the life he obtained upon believing was eternal life, while that which his faith had saved him from was an eternal doom? Who could believe in a special life for the aeons, when all the facts concerning these aeons had become obscure and blurred? As the truth regarding the aeons was completely lost, we ought to be very suspicious regarding the dogma which became orthodox and Catholic in a steadily apostatizing church. Tertullian. At this point we must turn to Carthage in North Africa, and in particular to Tertullian, and take careful note of their profound and lasting influence over Christendom. Tertullian lived from about 160 to 220 AD. Born at Carthage, he became a well-read scholar, an attractive orator and writer, a keen controversialist, and a clever lawyer. What origin was, about the same period, to Greek or Eastern Christianity, Tertullian was to Latin or Western Christianity. He was the first one to set about systematically to explain the scriptures in the Latin tongue of North Africa, and the first theologian to establish a technical Latin terminology for Christianity. It is no exaggeration to say that the choice of terms of this Latin scholar has profoundly affected all succeeding theological thought. It is to Tertullian that we owe such terms as Trinity, substance, person, redemption, justification, sanctification, sacrament, and many more, including probably such as perdition, perish, destroy, punish, torment, damnation, dispensation, predestination, revelation, priest, mediator, minister, congregation, propitiation, all terms from the Latin, although it is possible some of these may be due to Jerome. These terms are all different from the Greek words used, although some of the meanings correspond fairly well. Tertullian was the first writer to set out to expound the difficult doctrine of the Trinity, and to use this term, which, however, he does not use as a name for God. Dr. Glover says, he was the first man of genius of the Latin race to follow Jesus Christ, and to reset his ideas in the language native to the race. Archbishop Benson says, when Tertullian began to write, theological Latin had to be formed. Harnack says, what influenced the history of dogma was not his Christianity, but his masterly power of framing formulae. Up till his time, Roman Christianity had been essentially Greek in form. But when he embraced it, Latin terms and thoughts were introduced, which gradually but steadily altered the whole character of its teaching, and paved the way for the Roman Catholic system of dogma. Dr. Sweat says, the church in North Africa was the first Christian community so far as we know which offered the Eucharist for the benefit of the departed. One of the terms introduced by Tertullian was satisfaction. Harnack says, he was the first to regard definitely such ascetic performances as satisfaction, as propitiatory offerings by which the sinner could make amends to God. According to Tertullian, a comparatively brief ascetic punishment inflicted by the believer on himself took the place of what the damned were awarded eternal punishment. It should prove instructive to glance at some of his other views. Like many today, he could never come to grasp the important yet elementary fact that God is spirit. That God was conciliated was quite unknown to him and to those who followed in his steps. Being well trained in Roman law, he looked on God much more as the judge who gives the law and must be obeyed, than as the father of all. All relations between God and man partake of the nature of legal transactions, and thus a good act by man brings satisfaction to God and merit to man. But the fundamental relationship is that of fear on man's part. The great difference between the Greek Church and the Latin Church consisted in this, that the Greek Church looked upon revelation as expressing God in his relation to man, while the Latin Church began with man, and saw primarily man as in relation to God. God's measureless love and grace were viewed as at the disposal of man, or man was viewed as the fallen and guilty rebel measured up before the judge. The one commenced with God and his love, operating all things in accord with the counsel of his will from past ages for the ultimate good of the race, ever seeking to draw man to himself and instruct him with a view to his well-being and growth in grace. The other saw man as on probation, and God as the magistrate. Instead of men being gradually instructed in the ways and mind of God, they must subscribe without question or discussion to the creed, the rigid and crystallized expression of the Latin Church's views. As Farrar says, the center of Origen's system was God and hope, while that of Augustine's was punishment and sin. Whereas Origen yearns for a final unity, Augustine almost exultingly acquiesces in a frightful and abiding dualism. It was reserved for three great Carthaginians, Tertullian, Cyprian, and Augustine, so to influence the Latin Church that it deflected and declined into a system of dogmatic hierarchy and spiritual despotism. But Tertullian was the individual who set this current in motion. Through his powerful instrumentality, Christendom, at the critical juncture, took the wrong turn, and his influence still prevails. Neander says of him, that his mind was often at a loss for suitable forms of phraseology, as he had more within him than he could express, and for this purpose he was obliged to create a language for the new spiritual matter, out of the rude Punic Latin. It has been said that Tertullian often makes use of words not found in general use outside of the very early writers, and that he often imparts to words a new or unusual force. This, then, is the man in the hollow of whose hands lay the clay which was to be molded into concrete Latin dogma. This is the man in whose hands reclined the fate of the word eternal. What meaning did he give to it? Its old meaning, akin to the Greek Aeonian, or something beyond that. Being quite devoid of any understanding of the aeons of Scripture, destitute of a real perception of the fact that God is love, unable to view God but as a stern judge who must somehow or other be satisfied or placated, how was it possible for him to look on the mass of mankind otherwise than as damned? Augustine, who later outdid Tertullian and his doctrines, maintained that the whole human race was one damned batch and mass of perdition, conspiracist damnata, mass of perdition is, out of which a few are elected to salvation, while all the remainder are lost forever. He beheld evil as a force integral in a universe apart from God, while Origen believed that all is out from God, even evil, which God must undo and banish. One who has no place for aeons to come must needs look on the future as a shadowless eternity. Having failed to grasp what God had revealed concerning the aeons, Tertullian had no alternative but to impart to the Latin word eternal that sense which it now bears. Not only so, but this special meaning of the Latin word, taking advantage of the steady decline of Greek as the language of theology and the rise and ascendancy of Latin, reacted upon, and was imposed upon, its Greek equivalent Aeonian, which henceforth in theology was made to express the meaning of everlasting. At this point it will be interesting to bring forward the evidence of the ancient versions made from the Greek, and see whether they corroborate the conclusions to which we have come. How the old versions rendered them. The old Syriac version is thought to have been made from the Greek about the end of the 1st century or sometime during the 2nd century. The language is closely akin to Hebrew, and was very like the Aramaic which was spoken in Palestine side by side with Greek in the 1st century. To translate the Greek Aeon and Aeonian it uses Om, which is exactly the word used in the Hebrew scriptures, meaning obscure, or obscurity, that is, Aeonian and Aeon. The same constructions as occur in the Greek are shown, such as, from the Aeon emen Om, for the Aeon el Om, this Aeon, that Aeon, for the Aeons to come. For the Aeon of the Aeons Elom Olamine, the conclusion of the Aeons. To prove that Om did not and could not stand for eternity, it may be stated that the Greek word cosmos, world, is generally rendered in the Syriac version by Om, as in John 1:10, thrice, John 17:24, where the Syriac has, preceding the disruption of the Aeon. The Syriac version knew nothing about an eternity, and nothing in it is called eternal. The ancient Gothic version is of peculiar interest to the English-speaking and German-speaking peoples. In it are preserved the sole relies of a Germanic tongue spoken round 350 AD, which was very closely akin to the Old German and Old English spoken about that time. It was translated direct from the Greek, although only fragments have survived, mostly of the New Testament. It is a very faithful and literal rendering, and at times even reproduces the pronunciation of Greek words, where these are transliterated. Needless to say, being entirely free from the influence of Jerome's Latin version, it does not contain Latin terms such as perish, damnation, perdition, torment, eternal, punishment. It uses exclusively what were then native German words, very simple and elementary. The Gothic is the first rendering of the scriptures into any Teutonic tongue. The Goths were a very virile people from the north of Europe, who dominated most of Europe about the time this version was produced by Wulfilla. Spreading southwards, they overran Greece and Italy, and captured Rome in 410 AD. Eventually they seemed to have died out of the Mediterranean countries, and as a distinct people they became lost to history. To show how close Gothic comes to modern English, it may be pointed out that the following words are either spelt or sounded exactly the same in each: all, arm, blind, brother, corn, daughter, door, dumb, finger, full, grass, hand, heart, hard, lamb, land, light, little, lust, while, white, year, young. Very often the Gothic preserves the truth where modern English and German versions have become corrupt. Thus where the Anglo-Saxon version and the Authorized version often put life instead of soul, the Gothic has soul, siwil, as Wycliffe generally has also. In Luke 6, 1, where the avenue has, on the second Sabbath after the first, CV, on the second first Sabbath, Wycliffe has, in the second first Sabbath, the Anglo has on the after rest day first, while the Gothic, 1,000 years before Wycliffe's time, has, in Sabbath second first, in Sabbato antharama fumin. The Vulgate is also here correct. Similarly, in Mark 16, 9, the Vulgate and the Gothic support the CV, in the morning, in the first Sabbath, the Gothic reading, in morning, in first Sabbath, in magin fumin sabbato. Wycliffe here departs from the Vulgate by putting, early in the first day of the week, while Tyndale is also wrong, with the morrow after the Sabbath day. How then does the Gothic render the Greek Aeon and Aeonian? For the adjective it has in every one out of 24 occurrences erwanos, not very dissimilar from the Greek Aeondios. For the noun and it shows as or aves 20 out of 25 times, once it has life libens, and elsewhere two other expressions. as is the exact equivalent of the Latin evum and the Greek n. The following expressions are met with: do I wear, to or for the Ian, in air winds, in the Ian, under you, until the Ian, frame I wear, from the Ian, this airwise, this Ian, yean as airwise, yon Ian, that Ian, in the Ian to come, from the beginning of the Ian. In 2 Tim.1:9 the Gothic reads, former airwainer, before Ionian times, and in 2 Cor. 4:4, Gulf this airwise, the god of this Ian. Unfortunately, we are not able to tell how the Gothic read in most of Paul's epistles and the unveiling, as little has come down to us except parts of the four Gospels. The Coptic version, made probably about the end of the 2nd century, for use in Egypt, and still used there, appears to render the Hebrew om and the Greek n by an a word which is defined in Coptic dictionaries as meaning nothing more than time. The Armenian version is ascribed to Msrop 354-441 AD and others. Connie Bear says it fits the Greek of the Septuagint as a glove the hand that wears it, keeping so close to the Greek that it has almost the same value for us as the Greek text itself, from which the translator worked, would possess. For the Greek it generally uses Yavidon, a word meaning Ian. Sometimes Ashka, meaning world, is used instead. In Eph.2:2-CV, the Ian of this world, the two words are used together, Yavidini Ashka, his, meaning the same as does the CV or the special expressions in the Greek containing them, which are unknown to classical Greek, are found reproduced in the Armenian. In the Psalms, the same expressions which are found in the Septuagint occur in the Armenian, such as, for the Ian and for the Ian of the Ian. The root of the word Yavidon is Yaved, which is shown in Armenian dictionaries as meaning more, at most, a great deal. There is a verb, Yavilaum, which means to add, increase, augment, grow. Yavidon is defined as age, life, world, but when used in a theological sense, it is obliged to take on the opposite meaning, of eternity, perpetuity. The Ethiopic version, in the Semitic language formerly spoken in Abyssinia, is thought to have been made in the 4th or 5th century, from the Greek. It reproduces the usual Greek expressions containing Ian. The word used is om, exactly the same as in Hebrew and Syriac. In Jude 25 it reads, and for all the Ians ul kolomth, showing the plural form. In Heb.9:26 it reads, at the conclusion of the Ian, lchlqth om. In Eph.3:21 it reads, in every generation and for the Ian of the Ian, bklthalt ul om om. In the Psalms it has a few times, as in 45, 17, 48, 14, and 52, 8, for the Ian and for the Ian of the Ian, Elom, Uelom Om. That this word Om assuredly could not signify eternity is placed beyond all doubt by the fact that it is also used to represent the Greek word for world, cosmos, generally, as throughout John 17. It also stands for the Greek word for Erikeros, as in Mark 10:30 and Luke 18:30, and even for generation genia as in Luke 16:8. Old English versions were made not from the Greek, but from the Latin Vulgate, between the years 680 and 995. The four Gospels were done, and probably other parts. The Latin adjective aeternum, which Jerome used for Ionian, is always rendered by the little word eis, where Jerome for the noun has seculum. The Old English uses we ruled world in all 16 cases. Where Jerome has in aeternum, the Old English 8 times has ecnis, 5 times never with a negative in the Latin, and once ever. The two words, eis and world, will amply repay a little investigation. The once very common English word eis, which can be traced down till about 1260, although it disappeared as an adjective soon after that, is stated to come from the Old English verb ekan, meaning to prolong, augment, increase. The word survives as a verb, to eke, meaning to add, lengthen, and as an adverb, meaning, also, in addition. A nickname was originally an eke name, that is, an added name. In Scottish law, an aic is an addition to a legal document. The reason why the simple word eas was forced out of English probably was that it was too equivocal. Theology was trying to make it stand for everlasting, whereas it only meant lasting. These latter terms were to take its place, as in Cursa Mundi, the course of the world, a metrical version of Bible history, written about 1320, which is the line, through Jesus come to life lasting, through Jesu come to life last aunt. Soon after this time, the word everlasting took the place of eas and lasting, a transition which made a very great deal of difference. In present-day English, we may use the word world in two senses. We may speak of the world before the flood as meaning the race of mankind that lived then, or society as it then existed, or we may speak of it as meaning the physical earth as it then was. The latter sense was quite unknown in Old English, and only began to creep in about the year 1200, when it was so used in the long poem, the Ormulum. Prior to that time, world meant only the lifetime of man, the living generation of men, society as a whole at any time. It answered well to the Latin seculum, and was used from about the year 700 to translate it. Then it came to mean the physical earth on which the generations of men lived, and in much more recent times it came to be used of others' planets also. It might here be remarked that an extraordinary change was going on in English speech between the 12th and the 14th centuries. Up till the year 950 there was very little admixture of Latin or Danish words. The result of the Danish invasion meant that thousands of fine old poetic words became lost. From 1200 to 1280 was the most disastrous of all periods. A great many prose words disappeared, and the upper classes discarded English for French. For about 80 years after 1280 there was a vast inroad of French words to take the place of English words driven out of circulation, or forced to become merely dialectal. From about 1360 a new standard of English was spoken at court, and French ceased to be fashionable. It was what has been described as this wild anarchy of speech that was raging in England from 1300 to 1500 that caused many words to take on new meanings or lose their old meanings. These facts have been noted briefly merely because of their connection with John Wycliffe, and so that we may understand more clearly his usage of the word world. Wycliffe and his version. John Wycliffe was probably the first person to translate the whole Bible into the English tongue. He was born about 1320, at the time when the language of England was in the melting pot. He commenced by translating the Unveiling in 1356, and, with the help of collaborators, finished the entire Bible by 1382. 2 years later he died. Well did he live up to one of his sayings, that Christian men ought to travail night and day about text of Holy Writ. He is noteworthy as having been described as the one Englishman who during the past 1100 years was able to mould Christian thought on the continent of Europe. Not only was his private life irreproachable, but in his opposition to the claims of the Roman Church he was without fear of any man. In addition, he was a true scholar, and wrote a great many books, mostly in Latin. These became very popular in Bohemia, now part of the modern Czechoslovakia, as King Richard II of England had married the devout Princess Anne of Bohemia, a lover of the scriptures. While at Prague University, John Huss came under the influence of Wycliffe's writings, and in 1415 he was burnt at the stake for his faith. The followers of Huss became very numerous, and long-continued wars against them failed to extirpate them. Their powerful influence spread to the neighboring parts of Germany, including Saxony, where Martin Luther was born, who became a fearless champion of the scriptures. The Latin Vulgate version dominated Europe for the 1,000 years which lay between Jerome and Wycliffe, and longer. No one seems to have thought in those times of a Greek original, and in any case, the Greek language was all but forgotten in Europe. The Catholic Church used Latin in its services, and Latin had displaced Greek completely as the universal language of courts and clergy, and scholars. It will therefore be of great interest to observe how Wycliffe rendered the Latin of the Vulgate, and to note his views concerning the future. We shall find that his language differs markedly from that used by the various translations which were made from the time of Tyndale, 150 years after Wycliffe, including Coverdale's 1535, Cranmer's 1539, the Genevan 1557, and the Reims 1582, down to the Authorized of 1611. Never once does Wycliffe use the expression forever, or forever and ever. Though he uses everlasting, he never uses eternal. Had the Authorized version been the next English version to be made after Wycliffe's, it would never have found acceptance. As it was, it enjoyed the benefit of following closely on the lines of a number of fairly similar versions, which thus paved the way for it. Though the expressions used by Wycliffe are far from perfect, great is the decline manifested in the next English version to be published, Tyndale's. Tyndale brought in forever, forever and ever, forevermore, where Wycliffe expressed no such thought. Instead of the Reformation and the revival of learning bringing an added light regarding the times to come, they brought about gross darkness and confusion. As has been stated, Wycliffe used world to represent the Latin seculum, which Jerome used for the Greek. Instead of the modern forever and forever and ever, 29 times he has interworldize or interworldize of worldize. In Luke 1, 70 he has from the world, where the avenue has since the beginning of the world, cv, from the aeon. In Eph.3:9 he has fro worldize, where the avenue has from the beginning of the world, cv, from the aeons. In Rev.1:5:3 he has king of worldize, where the avenue has king of saints, mag, nations, or ages, cv, king of the aeons. In Heb.1:8 he has into the world of world, for the Latin into the seculum of the seculum, where the avenue has forever and ever, cv, for the aeon of the aeon. The following renderings from Eph.3, the 21st of May be contrasted, Wycliffe, into allied the generations of the world eyes. Tyndale, throughout all generations from Tim to Tim. Geneva, throughout all generations forever. Reims, unto all generations world without end. Coverdale, at all times forever and ever. Avenue, throughout all ages, world without end. CV, for all the generations of the aeon of the aeons. In Heb.9:26 Wycliffe has in the ending of world eyes, where the Reims version also retains the plural, in the consummation of the world as. Tyndale, Coverdale, Cranmer and the Genevan all corrupt this into in the end of the world, which is followed by the avenue C. V, at the conclusion of the aeons. Similarly, in Heb.11:3, Wycliffe and the Reims preserve the plural worlds, corresponding to the Vulgate seculums cv, the aeons. In Heb. 13:8, Wycliffe alone preserves some semblance of the truth, reading into world eyes, where the later English versions have continueth forever, avenue, forever, cv, for the aeons. In 1 Peter 4:11, Wycliffe has into the world eyes of world eyes. Tyndale wished to bring in eternity, and at the same time retain world. He therefore ended by forever and will the world standeth. The other versions of about his time relapse into forever and ever. In Psalm 90, to anyone can see how much more faithful Wycliffe is to the Hebrew, which reads, from Olam until Olam thou art deity. Avenue, from everlasting to everlasting, thou art God. Coverdale, thou art God from everlasting and world without end. Wycliffe, from the world and into the world thou art God. We have seen that the Latin Vulgate had an extraordinary reading in Exodus 15:18, into eternity and further. This must have seemed very strange to Wycliffe and his assistants. They might have compromised by putting what the later versions put, forever and ever. But they wished to be as faithful as their light allowed them. Considering that they understood by world what we now understand by aeon, it is greatly to their credit that we should find them rendering this, 550 years ago by the Lord shall reign into the world, and first single quote e, further. A rendering of Wycliffe which it is stated many will find preferable to the authorized version is found in John 11:26, "Yea, that liveth and believeth in me shall not die with aught and for shall never die." Only three times does Wycliffe use the word never. None of these has any reference to life or salvation. In Mark 11:14 and John 13:8 he had, Wycliffe, "Now never at any man for eat of thee more." CV, "No longer may anyone be eating fruit of you for the Ian." Wycliffe, "Thou shalt never waste my feet." CV, "Under no circumstances should you be washing my feet for the Ian." But in the revision of Wycliffe's Bible by Pavey, 1388, this is altered to "now no more with aught and" in the former case, while the latter reads, "Thou shalt not waste to me the feet into with aught and." In fact, Pavey altered about half or more of the occurrences of "with aught and" into "with aught and." It would therefore appear that both Wycliffe and Pavey did not feel satisfied regarding the expression "without end," which might be, and certainly later was, misunderstood. They must have had more than a suspicion that "without end" was not an adverbial phrase, equivalent to "endlessly," but really a noun, as in Latin and Greek, meaning a period of time whereof the end was not disclosed. Just as the periods or olames in Hebrew are obscure in duration, so Wycliffe looked on the coming eons as periods whose ends were not defined. What we call the eon he called the "with aught end." The world. What did Wycliffe understand by this word? We have seen that about his time the word was coming to take on a new meaning which it never had before, that of the physical world, whereas formerly it had only referred to the transient world of humanity as seen in connection with the passing course of time. Wycliffe used it in the old primitive sense, as equivalent to aeon. This was the sense in which the word was used in the Old English versions, for 700 years before Wycliffe. To express the physical world or earth, Old English, and also Old German, used another term, Middelgrund, middle yard or ward, which was the middle region between heaven above and the region below. A sermon on Mark 24:43 once much preached by Dan Michael of Northgate 1340, but very popular long before his time, contains the words, "Those that dwell in thine house for worlds of worlds, to that one yeth in thine house in wordles of wordles." No one could have understood "worlds of worlds" as meaning a succession of new earths or of planets. The words meant ages, or eons. Wycliffe, it would seem, came near to restoring a great truth to its proper place. Had he had the Greek text before him, there is little doubt that he would have accomplished this. As it was, the inconsistency of the Latin Vulgate obliged him also to be somewhat inconsistent, and this may be the reason why versions which came after his time most unfortunately used "world" in a sense different from his usage. By Tyndale's time, "world" had come to be used as meaning a state or place, rather than a limited period of time. In his Synonyms of the New Testament, Archbishop Trench draws a contrast between cosmos, world, and aeon, both of which are rendered in the authorized version by "world." In the case of he thinks more use might have been made of "age." He regrets that the translators did not somehow mark the difference between cosmos, mundus, the world contemplated under aspects of space, and seculum, the same contemplated under aspects of time, as Latin, like Greek, has two distinct words, where we have, or have acted as though we had, but one. In a note he shows that the word "world," etymologically regarded, more nearly represents than cosmos. Our old word here ruled is composed of two distinct parts, and where the primitive pronunciation is preserved, two very distinct syllables are still heard. The former part of the word consists of were, a man, like the Latin ver, as in virile, and the erring words like speaker, also the word in the wolf, the man wolf. The latter part of the word is old, or eld, meaning age or generation. World is therefore defined as the generation of men. That there is a close connection between the old word world and aeon was beautifully shown by the old Gothic version, which, into Tim.4, 10 has, for this present world, CV, the current Ian, the reading, too new old, meaning, this now age. Quite apart from the manner in which Wycliffe translated the scriptures, however, we are not left in any doubt as to his views regarding future time. Among his voluminous works in Latin, there is one called Trialogus, or a discussion between three parties, whom he calls Truth, Liar, and Prudence. This contains a dissertation on the distinction between eternity, aeons, and time, extending to over 1,000 words. He says, it is one matter for a thing to exist always, and another for a thing to be eternal. The world exists always, because at every time, and yet it is not eternal, because it is created, for the moment of creation must have a beginning, as the world had. Between God and the world he draws a sharp distinction as regards their mode of existence. God alone can be eternal, without change or mutation, without fore and after. The world, on the other hand, has a mutable existence, including a fore and an after. The world experiences the continual succession of time. Yet for the saints, and spiritual beings, such as angels, he perceived the third form of existence, the evan life, which we should term aeonian life. He supposed that in this life there would be no succession of time. Neither would it be the brief fleeting life of this world, nor would it be eternal. It would be something in between these. Doubtless Wycliffe did not have full light regarding the aeons to come, yet it seems extraordinary that he could have seen so much as he did, when we consider that he had to depend altogether on the blurred light and inconsistent evidence of the Latin Vulgate. Many there are today, who, with all the clear evidence of the Greek scriptures set out before them, deliberately reject the terms which God has seen fit to use, and fall back on expressions which are certainly not found in the scriptures. They imagine that the teaching regarding the aeons is a modern invention. One such, an educated man, who passes for a scholar, and has written a book dealing with the Greek language, recently made the charge regarding the term aeonian in the concordant version that is a word which looks as if it had been coined for the purpose. It required to be pointed out to him that this was exactly the expression used by God frequently in the scriptures, and that the terms he preferred, such as eternal and everlasting, had really no authority in Revelation. One fine old book, published in 1761 and entitled Universal Restitution, consists of well over 400 pages showing forth proofs that aeonian is the proper scriptural term to use. We shall close our review by giving a few extracts. Christ is the very God of the aeons, and may be called the aeonian God and King, not on account of his eternal nature, but because he shall reign aeonianly, as universal King, and because he is most strictly speaking the God of the aeonian life. And also because the ages or aeons are all under his government and direction. In this view of things, death, and hell, and pain, and sorrow, appear to be not as usually looked upon, accidental creatures that stole into existence by a sort of chance, or some kind of inadvertency in God, but the provisionary creatures of God's wisdom and goodness, preordained, by reason of a fitness in their nature, to produce, in the contingent casualties foreseen, the great events of his benevolence, and communicative inclinations, which, when they shall have fully served, being creatures of a temporary, and aeonian consistence, they must vanish and be no more. Thus briefly would we summarize the conclusions we have arrived at. The facts of Revelation regarding the aeons having been early obscured and lost, and the Greek Church having declined, the Latin Church, with its own version, rose into prominence. The Latin version was only a translation, and was therefore not inspired. It changed the import of certain very important inspired time words as found in the Greek, and gave them a different shade of meaning. The effect was sufficient to produce an utterly distorted outlook on the entire future, and to make God appear to be at one and the same time both a loving father and a cruel and capricious monster. In fact, no God at all. The Reformation, which was a reformation along certain lines only, instead of undoing and reversing this grievous error of the Latin Church, actually confirmed it and established it. On the other hand, every ancient version of the scriptures, and every modern or medieval translation, either by its consistency where it is consistent, or by its inconsistency, proves the concordant version to be correct in its renderings of the words under examination. Every translation which does not consistently use the words aeon and aeonian, or age and age abiding, or some such terms, is obliged to make use of at least two mutually contradictory expressions. Verily indeed, it is a strong claim which we make on behalf of the concordant version, but we make it without fear of its being refuted, and without fear of any opposition, that it is the only version, which, by its system, adequately recognizes the scriptures as God-breathed. This article was originally serialized in Unsearchable Riches magazine, volume 26, nos. 5 and 6, Sept. and November 1935. They were later reprinted in booklet form, with some alterations from this text, under the title Whence Eternity. Concordant Publishing Concern. Return to main index page,